supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to a Voices in the Family special here on WHYY. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We heard about the massacre at Parkland High School in Florida. And then there's the struggling working class who feel they have not been listened to by the government in decades. Both sides are likely to feel the life they want is at risk. And both are convinced they are on the right side of the argument. There's plenty to be outraged about, but this sustained rage takes its toll on our bodies and our emotions. The result could be exhaustion and a sense of helplessness. So, what can we do? How do we harness our outrage and translate it into something both mentally and socially productive? We're also going to explore social movements and try to understand why some succeed while others fail.
When we're building social movements, I think we have to start small, that most effective social movements have started with building connection with people directly around us and then figuring out how do we win an ever-expanding circle of allies.
My guests are Dr. Ellie Brown, a psychology professor at Westchester University who facilitates local, national, and international workshops for leaders and activists in social movements. We're also joined by Dr. Michael Gariziak. He's a psychology professor at Westchester. Also, he specializes in mindfulness-based interventions for treating depression, substance abuse disorders, and PTSD.
We need to take a break and slow down and to pay attention to ourselves and to take care of ourselves in a better way.
Ellie, I want to start at the beginning, and that's these social movements. How did they get started in the first place?
A lot of times we view protests as the start of a social movement, but usually there's a lot that lays a base for successful protest even before that protest breaks out. So there's a lot of organizing, grassroots efforts that lay the ground for successful protest. When we think about protest, we often think about anger, frustration. We think about grievances, people being upset about something that they want to change. You know, anger can be useful in that way. It can initiate action. It can motivate us to take action, to make changes. So I think sometimes that is an important ingredient in the start of social movements.
Frankly, I'm surprised that you say sometimes.
Well, when you think about that groundwork, so you think about anger being an emotional response, but anger doesn't necessarily facilitate our clear thinking. You have people often thinking clearly who are identifying problems, injustices in our society that require solutions, and who are starting to build grassroots organizing efforts to address those problems. Their work is not necessarily motivated by anger. Anger might be part of what initiates large groups of people to take to the streets in protest. But those people might be just thinking about, okay, what are next steps for bringing us closer to broader social goals of justice and equity?
So what does a social movement need to be successful?
I think when we're talking about anger, the problem is we're often talking about, or outrage, we're talking about a reaction to something that's wrong. And a social movement needs a lot more than that to be successful. You need a vision of what are we actually moving toward, right? Movement implies that. Whereas, you know, reaction is against something, movement implies progress towards something. And so what is that vision? What are we moving toward? And most successful social movements have had a broad vision.
I want to hear your thoughts, Ellie, about other kinds of social movements and whether they are social movements. I'm thinking about the Tea Party politically, for example, and it's now the Freedom Caucus, who were very successful in creating change in Congress. And just how successful the gun lobby has been. In a way, they either created social movements or accessed some kind of discontent, some anger, that then created a social movement.
Yeah, and when you're talking about the Tea Party or Freedom Caucus, you're talking about giving voice to people who felt unheard. And that is often important for mobilization, right? The ability to give voice to people who have felt like they don't have voice, including through standard political processes.
Like Ellie just addressed, we all want to be heard. I mean, from infancy through death, we want to be seen for who we are. We want our voice heard, our suffering heard, just in the family, for individuals. You know, you have an adolescent who doesn't feel heard. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do? You know, they're either going to withdraw or they're going to act out. They're going to get PO'd, at least. These young people in Florida who mobilize these marches around the world, they taught our country many things. They've taught the world many things. But one of the things they demonstrate is another option to deal with outrage. Instead of sitting behind a TV or a computer with a clenched fist railing at whoever, they turn it into action. We all have brains that search for meaning. We want to take adversity and turn it into meaning. I mean, that's the way our brains are wired, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a great effort to make meaning of the senseless tragedy that happened and to try to move forward through that and to, in a constructive way, maybe be agents of change or try to facilitate some good that came out of this or to try to spread some sort of message or communicate in order to foster change in the world.
That's got to be one of the elements, certainly, in this social movement that these young people have started. But in all of them, that's got to be woven in there. Yes, Ellie, about wanting to make meaning.
Absolutely, and about taking action to alleviate feelings of outrage and to alleviate outrage fatigue. Action is an antidote to that fatigue that, we think about, we're going to become fatigued if we work hard. But if we're actually able to work hard in ways that we can tell there is an effect of our actions, that is rejuvenating. That is what can keep us feeling alive and hopeful. So I think absolutely that ability to take action is important for countering the outrage fatigue that we can experience as unjust things happen all around us.
I have to tell you, on a personal level, I found leadership in these young people, and I feel re-energized. And I wonder if that's got to be a major factor in a successful social movement, is to energize the larger community.
Absolutely. And I think there are older seasoned activists who play a very important role in all of the social movements, including, behind the scenes laying the ground for the work by these young people to be successful. But teenagers, young people have played important roles in most of our successful social movements.
How and so?
Often young people who are not fully entrenched in some of our societal institutions are able to have perspective outside of them and to see the possibility for change. Often young people are willing to take risks to challenge the powers that be. And yeah, you see these young people having amazing energy and also the real power of building relationships, connecting with people, being able to express themselves in authentic ways that we all relate to, we have empathy for, and I think that is important to the success they've had so far.
Wow. I didn't realize the youth element in so many successful social movements.
Absolutely.
So, Michael, what's the difference between anger that energizes us and anger that just burns us out? I mean, I'm talking about social movements, but I'm also talking about the workplace too.
Sure. I think anger that is more exhausting or that leads to burnout has a relationship with the outcome and the desired changes that you want to see happen. And I think anger can be more of a burnout factor if there's not change that you're seeing be affected, or if that you feel like you're not causing any significant shifts in your life or in a broader community or in a social movement. So I think anger in that way can be depleting and can lead to kind of counterproductive outcomes. I think anger is more can be more energizing when it's used as fuel or used as a way to inform your responsiveness to try to be a more causal agent to change the world in the way that you want to change it, to respond to injustices or to assert yourself in a way that facilitates change.
As individuals, how can we avoid burning out?
I think it has to do with how we take care of ourselves and what we do for ourselves when we're feeling distressed or when we're feeling upset or when we're feeling like our emotions are becoming exhausting in any way. And I think that is something that is oftentimes easier to do than we think it is, but it's something that we oftentimes overlook and neglect to do. We neglect to take care of ourselves very often.
Yeah, oftentimes we suffer and don't even know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
When we watch TV, you know, and read the papers, you know, we might feel outrage by what we see, but what we don't know is that we suffer when this happens. And when we suffer, we need care. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about social movements and outrage fatigue. My guests are Drs. Ellie Brown and Michael Gariziak. They're both professors of psychology at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. You're listening to this Voices in the Family special right here on WHYY. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special here on WHYY. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today on the show, we're exploring outrage fatigue, the feeling of exhaustion or helplessness we get after consuming too much bad news. My guests are Dr. Ellie Brown, a psychology professor at Westchester University, who facilitates local, national, and international workshops for leaders and activists in social movement. I'm also joined by Michael Gariziak, a psychology professor at Westchester University, who specializes in mindfulness-based interventions for treating depression, substance abuse disorders, and PTSD. Michael, we've established that anger is a judicial emotion. It's a reaction to injustice. So that's a good thing, yes?
I think it can be. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that our emotions, generally speaking, aren't necessarily good or bad, but that our emotions are sources of information that we have about ourselves and our environment. I think it's important to recognize the difference between when our emotions drive reactivity versus when they can inform our thoughtful responsiveness and more well-informed action. For example, if I am upset by something that a friend does to me or something a friend says to me, it would be, I think, more adaptive and skillful if I were to recognize that that upset me and to respond in a skillful way by communicating in some way or another to this friend, you know, hey, this upset me when you did this, rather than being upset by it and just reacting in more of a reflexive manner without the presence of mind to recognize that I'm being reactive or without the risk of saying something I might regret.
At one point, anger harms both the individual and the cause. What kind of harm does it do?
Anger can harm ourselves if we hold on to it for an excessive period of time, if we don't take healthy courses of action to recognize our anger and resolve it. And by resolve it, it could be any number of things. So either processing it, talking about it, or taking a course of action to address whatever it was that made us angry or upset in the first place. So I think if we don't address our emotions or our anger in the first place in a healthy way, then we're at risk for holding on to it and for it to kind of eat us up from the inside.
I hear in discussions all the time, I'm entitled to my anger. Look at what they did. Look at what they're about to do. My anger is justified. So where does that get me, Ellie?
Well, sure. We all have the right to feel the emotions we feel, and that's important to recognize, that our emotions are valid. If we feel a particular emotion, we feel that for some reason. We often think about our emotions as being born out of a particular sociocultural, sociopolitical moment or a particular moment in our lives, and yet often we bring to the current moment emotions that are tied to past experiences. And I think that's often the case in terms of anger or outrage, that we might experience anger in the current moment. And if that marks something unjust that's happening currently, then that's good. It's useful to feel that anger to mark current injustice, but we might also bring to the current situation a buildup of times when we've been unfairly treated in the past, for example, or have experienced or witnessed injustice. And we might have a buildup of anger that we bring to the present situation or that's triggered, re-stimulated by the present situation. That's not so useful. It doesn't belong in the present moment. So that's part of, I think, what's important to separate, being able to process what about this is current, what about this is old, and how can we get rid of enough of the emotional charge to be able to think clearly going forward. Because although emotions serve as useful markers to tell us, for example, when something is unjust or to motivate us to take action to change something, they don't facilitate our clear thinking. And to take productive action over a sustained period of time, we need clear thinking.
Okay, sounds great. How do we get there?
What I think some psychology research has shown is that outrage often sits on top of other emotions. One of those emotions is guilt. So a lot of times we feel moral outrage when we feel guilty about something that happened. Maybe we feel like if, for example, if something racist happens, I'm sitting here as a white person, I feel guilty about my role as a white person and my role in racism. Well, if I am given opportunities to take effective action toward ending racism, then it tends to help not only with my feelings of guilt, but also with the feelings of outrage.
I hear that phrase, moral outrage, and I first heard it, to be honest, at a conference I was at University of Pennsylvania, where they talked about combat veterans who felt moral trauma. You know, you go to the war and you kill someone. Well, that's a trauma, but in a way, it's a moral trauma, taking the life of someone else. So I want to hear more about this moral outrage. What is it?
So we think about outrage as being a combination of emotions, surprise, disgust, anger. And we think about moral outrage as involving a perceived violation of a moral boundary, of a sacred moral value. And sometimes that is about our own actions. Sometimes it is about something happening to a third party, to someone outside of us. And, you know, those situations are somewhat different because in some cases we are feeling that high level of physiological arousal as well as negative emotion and this perception of a moral violation. In other cases, you know, something unjust happens to someone else. Well, we might think, hey, that violates my moral boundaries, but we might not actually have that internal experience of physiological arousal and true outrage.
So we need something collective. We can't do it by ourselves. We have to join up with others for most things. I mean, we're social animals. How do I do that?
I think that's so important, just the issue of connectedness, that connectedness also is an antidote to outrage. And often we feel helpless and hopeless when we feel isolated. And so the ability to connect, to come together collectively, is really important for breaking that down and also to gain perspective that it's not my fault. It's not my personal problem that I experienced this or that I feel outrage, that other people have experienced this too. Other people feel outrage too. That can be really important for alleviating the negative impact of the outrage. And when we're building social movements, I think we have to start small, that most effective social movements have started with building connection with people directly around us or who we really have a close common bond with, creating a shared consciousness, and then figuring out how do we win an ever-expanding circle of allies. So how do we reach out to a next layer of individuals? If you think about the teenagers in Florida, some of them were in school together. They already have social relationships and that bond, and they're developing this shared consciousness. And then the question of, okay, reaching out to the next closest allies. So there are students in other schools, but there are also teachers, parents that they can form alliances with.
One of the things I keep hearing with people involved in social movements, people who have overcome great adversity to accomplish great things. The one word that comes out is a variant on devotion. I'm going to do this, and you're not going to stop me, and I'm going to do it almost no matter what. Does that make sense to you, Michael, with how people accomplish things?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have that passionate intention and that drive to accomplish any goals. And if someone is really animated and really passionate about something, that devotion is going to play a huge role in how long they're able to persevere in pursuing that goal or pursuing that change, and the degree of energy that they'll have throughout that pursuit of that goal.
Yeah, I keep thinking of that opening two words in one of the steps in the 12-step programs, and it became ready. Mm. Is those two words. It's became ready. You know, I'm here. I'm ready. Let's get to work. And without that, it's just an idea, a concept. You know, and apropos of that, Ellie, some social movements start off with a great deal of energy and power, but then they decline. And I guess one reason why they decline is because they've achieved their goals.
Well, there are other reasons, but you're right that for a social movement to have sustainability, you have to have a plan for not only how do you achieve the tangible small goals along the way to the big picture goals, but then what do you do after you achieve success on those specific programmatic goals you've outlined? You know, what's the plan for the bigger picture? And a lot of the social movements we see have revolutionary goals in mind. If you think about the Black Lives Matter movement, talking about goals of ending racism, broadly speaking, right? That means dismantling white supremacy and racism that are built into the fabric of our society. That requires revolutionary change in the society. And yet there are these very tangible intermediate goals about, for example, diversity training for police. And so how does a movement like that work toward achieving those intermediate goals and also have a plan for, okay, what are we going to do next? What are the ways that we are going to actually work to transform the society that perpetuates racism? And what we're really after when we're after permanent change is we're after a change in people's hearts and minds, right? There's that quote that the change we're after is in people's hearts and minds. And that is is so critically important because we can change a particular law, we can change a particular institutional practice, and still see injustice recreated. For example, still see racism recreated in new forms, because racism, of course, resides within people who make up those institutions in our society. So as a white person, if I hold racism inside of me, which I do. My intention is to be a good ally and accomplice and to not act in racist ways, but I've been conditioned as a white person to, you know, have racist messages in my head. So, of course, there are ways that unawarely I'm going to perpetuate racism until that changes, until my mind actually changes, until I'm able to reprocess certain things. And that's a level on which I don't think we've seen most social movements have as much success as we could, that there's a level of emotional, mental, psychological change that needs to happen for permanent change on most social issues. And we've only begun to figure out what needs to happen to create that kind of change in people's hearts and minds.
So, Michael, I've got a simple question for you, and that's, how do you change people's hearts and minds? Maybe three steps would be good.
Sure, that's a very simple question to answer. How do you change people's hearts and minds?
Well, start with how do you change your own?
Sure. So, so we've talked in the past about one approach that we both have a personal interest in and professional interest as well, and that's through mindfulness and mindfulness meditation-based exercises. I think we're oftentimes so busy and we're so preoccupied with things going on around us, with our job, with politics, with any number of things, that we end up holding a lot of emotions that we're not aware of, which leads us to be more reactive, less tolerant of ourselves, less tolerant of others. And maybe that we need to take a break and slow down and to pay attention to ourselves and to take care of ourselves in a better way. One way of doing that is through mindfulness meditation and through taking intentional actions to slow down and just to be aware of what's going on in the moment within us, to adopt a more conscientious and present-focused attention, to give ourselves a break and give ourselves a little space from everything going on, and to develop a sense of acceptance.
I never met anyone yet, anyway, that will judge another person harshly and feel good about themselves at the same time.
Sure.
I've never seen that.
I think that's so important also when we're talking about social movements. So you're right. You know, if we talk about something like racism, for example, of course, its most insidious effects are on people targeted by racism, people of color. And yet racism corrupts all of our minds. It corrupts the minds of white people also. And to be able to end racism, I think we need white people broadly to recognize that, to recognize that it doesn't do any of us good to hold these negative ideas, attitudes, beliefs, or to act on those. I think that's where you've seen certain social movements gain momentum and be successful. For example, in the case of the first wave of feminism, so you have Simone de Beauvoir, who writes this book, The Second Sex, where she argues that women's liberation is connected to men's liberation. And then you have Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her close circle of friends who make an argument that when we are asking for women to gain more rights, like the right to vote, we're talking about promoting democratic ideals. We're talking about promoting the ideals this country is founded on, doing things that are going to benefit everybody. And I think for any social movement to be successful, it needs to be able to connect those specific issues that might target one particular group to the well-being of all of us.
We're going to have to take a short break now. We're going to continue our discussion on outrage fatigue with Dr. Ellie Brown. She's a psychology professor at Westchester who facilitates local, national, and international workshops for leaders and activists in social movements. We're also joined by Michael Gariziak, also a psychology professor at Westchester. He specializes in mindfulness-based interventions for treating depression, substance use, and PTSD. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today we're talking about outrage fatigue and the psychology of social movements. My guests are Dr. Michael Gariziak, a psychology professor at Westchester who specializes in mindfulness-based interventions, and Dr. Ellie Brown, also a psychology professor at Westchester, and she facilitates local, national, and international workshops for leaders and activists in social movements. I want to comment, both of you, about social movements that have happened both with Barack Obama's presidency and Donald Trump's. They both organized very powerful and effective movements. And when I think about it, they both had a lot in common. One might have been about hope, and one might have been about fear, but they were both about the pursuit of justice. And they both had very positive outcomes. Do you see these similarities?
I do see the similarities you're talking about in terms of that call for justice. And as we've mentioned earlier, justice for people who have not felt heard or have not felt they had a voice in the political process in certain ways. So how can we bring justice to those who have not experienced it? I do think, though, that campaigns or social movements that are built on hope have more lasting power than those that are built on fear or other negative emotion. That hope, interest, engagement is much more useful for facilitating our clear thinking, our collaboration toward positive change, than re-stimulating people's negative emotions like fear or anger.
Fear, anger are more likely to get results than hope. Yeah, we mobilize the emotions in everybody. You know, we get them to vote with emotions. I mean, my God, look at all these campaign ads for, you know, how many hundred years, if not more. It's these big negative emotions that motivate people to do things.
Well, fear and anger motivate short-term responses. And so winning a single election, maybe can buy that on the basis of fear. But in terms of working toward our longer-term best interests, we need the positive emotions. We need hope. We need interest. We need engagement. We need a lack of that physiological arousal that comes with fear and anger that overwhelms our bodies and our minds, that swamps our ability to think clearly.
So speaking of it overwhelming our minds, it certainly overwhelms the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that says, maybe not. That's off duty when we're angry. So, Mike, I want to turn to you. How do we get the rational brain back online?
So I think it's, as I was saying, I think it's important to recognize that the fear and the anger maybe compels us in the short run. And I think that's because there's a sense of urgency with those emotions. So recognizing those things and recognizing them as maybe short-term energy or fuel, that's going to maybe be exhausted more quickly than the hope. But as far as how to maybe channel some of our emotions in a more productive way, or maybe to address some of these issues in a way that's more healthy and helpful for us in the long run, is to recognize when these intense emotions are going on within us, because we often neglect to consider how we are in any given moment. We're so preoccupied with our jobs. We're so preoccupied with any number of things that we don't give pause to give ourselves space to just be. We're more engaged in this doing mode where we're running around, trying to achieve, trying to resolve issues. And when we slow down and allow ourselves to be, we can, I think, take better care of ourselves, have more flexibility in identifying what we need and how to move forward.
You're working on something called emotional dysregulation. First of all, I want to know what that is and how we get dysregulated in the first place.
Sure. So there's a number of ways we can become emotionally dysregulated. But generally speaking, I think of emotion dysregulation as when there's some emotion that's present that feels overwhelming or excessively taxing to us or our system. And that leads to maybe a compromise in our functioning, maybe a compromise in our ability to think through things clearly, or a compromise in our ability to take an intelligent course of action to resolve something. So it's when I think the emotion exceeds our ability to cope with it.
Often, I would imagine, and I've seen it in my office, that something slight on the surface anyway will trigger a big emotion. Small input, big emotion. And to me, that's one symptom of emotional dysregulation.
Mm-hmm.
How do we fix it? Regulate it. So tell us how.
I think, as we were talking about all along, it's both recognizing and validating that there's something there in the first place. Oftentimes, we're not aware of our emotions. Someone says, oh, you're upset, and you yell at them, I'm not upset, I'm not angry. So I think a big first step is just recognizing that there is an emotion that's present and allowing it to be there in many ways, just saying, like, this is here, it is what it is. And after you can recognize it and maybe give some space to it, making the decision to not react so that that prefrontal area you're talking about is able to come on board and to come into play.
How do we get there? I mean, it's not just a decision. It's practice. We have to almost rewire our brains, our limbic system.
Sure. So one of the techniques that I teach in many of these mindfulness-based interventions is just slowing down. It's slowing down and even taking a breath. So in the addiction recovery mindfulness groups that I teach, when individuals are triggered by something, when something happens that's really emotionally challenging for them, which leads them to want to pick up and use again, what we talk about is slowing down, recognizing that there's an emotion there, and then quite literally taking their attention and focusing on the experience of a breath, just taking in a deep breath and filling the breath, fill the lungs and fill the body, and then feeling the release and the relief that comes with the exhale of the breath. This sounds overly simplistic, but it's something that we often don't do. We're very hardwired and conditioned to react to our environment. When we feel emotions, we want to react to them by pushing them away or by resolving them immediately. And oftentimes that can be counterproductive. Suppressing our emotions actually isn't very effective and can make those emotions bigger and can make them harder to deal with. So just taking a breath, giving yourself some space and some acceptance to experience an emotion can help have a more skillful and flexible way of dealing with that emotion and responding to it rather than reacting.
So when my mother said, Danny, count to three, she had some, what, Buddhist background?
Presumably, yes, yeah. So I could see that going any number of ways. But I could see that being frustrating, saying, all right, I'll count to three. But there is some truth to that, though, is slowing down before we take action, right? It's slowing down, counting to three, taking a breath, giving yourself some space between whatever that event or that trigger or that emotionally arousing thing is and your response.
It's not an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Ellie, to me, this emotional dysregulation is what our political dialogue is experiencing now, that we're so reactive to each other. And I'll bet if I invited people on both sides of the political spectrum and I said to them, all right, sit down, relax a little bit, you know, just let go of your beliefs just for a little bit. My guess is they would either justify what they were doing or call me an idiot or naive. So do you agree that we need to let go of these rigidly held beliefs just a little?
Well, sure. And our negative emotions often hold in place our rigid beliefs. And that's where we need that emotional support in order to create those changes in people's hearts and minds. If I were trying to identify three steps to that, I would say one is about awareness. Another is about connection. So we do need to sit down with each other. We do need to be face to face. And another is about that emotional expression, being able to emotionally process, regulate. And so you have the impact of that on a personal level in terms of, well, how do I regulate my emotions? From the model I use with leaders in social change work, we use a model of peer support. So we provide support to one another to do that. The first step being awareness about those emotions, another step being connecting with each other, feeling heard by each other, and then another step being the ability to express, release, and regulate. And I think the same steps apply to changing people's hearts and minds to bring about political or social change. That for that to happen, you need a certain level of education or awareness. People need to have information available, but we know that's not sufficient because if people are swamped by negative emotion, they can't effectively process that information. We might hold accurate information and not be able to act on the basis of that if negative emotions are in the way. So we also need to be able to process those emotions, and we need to connect with one another.
Easier said than done, huh?
Easier said than done, but possible. I would hold out that there are models. Mike's work with mindfulness is one very important model for emotion regulation, and in the context of social movements, I think the model of peer support is really important, that we do need to sit down face to face with one another, listen to each other's stories, be able to express our emotions and feel heard in those ways. And there are models for implementing that.
Michael, you've done a good deal of research about the effectiveness of mindfulness meditation. And we could fill libraries with the research on mindfulness meditation. But somehow I can't envision Ted Cruz and Donald Trump sitting on a meditation cushion with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. I just can't imagine getting that in my head. So there's a difference between meditation mm-hmm. and mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that group might not be sitting on a cushion.
Sure.
But they can be more mindful.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I often start every mindfulness class I teach by talking about what meditation is and isn't. And I usually say we are not going to sit on the floor, fold our legs up into pretzels and chant or say om or anything like that. I think of meditation as simply a mental exercise, much in the same way as you might go to the gym to exercise your body. We can engage in mental exercises or meditations. So that's just a broad term or phrase to describe that. With mindfulness, though, mindfulness is simply the practice of being aware in the present moment and coupled with this non-judgmental attitude. So can we be aware of one another? Can we be able to communicate to one another? Can we be receptive to what the other person has to say? And yeah, it's very unlikely we'll be able to get those politicians in one room and sitting and meditating. But maybe there's hope that we could facilitate some more mindfulness in the communication. And by that, I mean just in general with our communication, as two people are talking, and if one person is speaking, the other person likely isn't actively listening, but is already generating what their response is going to be before that other person finishes speaking. So usually there's already kind of an absence going on in one or both parties when they're communicating. Rather than listening, I'm thinking, what do I want to say? When do I want to jump in? How can I get my point across? Rather than really hearing out and really processing and being receptive to what the other person is saying. So I think there are mindfulness exercises that can facilitate that ability to listen and communicate. And I think that would be maybe something we could hope for, more respectful and mindful and aware communication among our politicians.
When I look at these young people in Florida, what I'm seeing is post-traumatic growth, which rarely gets talked about and is not something that happens to a minority. Most who go through trauma experience growth. Are you seeing this with these kids in Florida? Ellie, Michael?
Absolutely. And I think when you're bringing up that opportunity for growth, that is closely tied with the opportunity to take productive action moving forward. So when we think about helplessness and hopelessness, some of my research focuses on learned helplessness for children, for example, who face poverty-related stressors, who might face uncontrollable events in their environment, things like dangerous neighborhoods or high rates of residential moves or household chaos. And we know that one of the ways that we can counter learned helplessness is to provide children with strategies and opportunities for having control over their life outcomes, or if we're talking about educational outcomes, for having control over those educational outcomes. The same thing is true in the face of trauma, that if you experience trauma, one of the ways to be sure that becomes an opportunity for growth, you know, of course, in addition to the emotional healing that's needed, is providing channels for productive action. When we have a way to control outcomes going forward, that can greatly alleviate that sense of helplessness that we might feel in the face of acute trauma.
What's the goal of social movements? It's to create change, but is it to create change through power and disruption, like we've seen with many of these movements we've talked about today? Or is it to negotiate, to sit down at the table and negotiate?
Well, I think in the case of our social movements that are viewed as most successful, they include both elements, that often you need people willing to create certain disruptions so that people take notice, so that they consider the possibility for radical change. And you also need people willing to sit down and negotiate and be willing to make compromises that are part of the reforms that might bring us closer to those revolutionary or radical changes. We saw that, for example, with the second wave feminist movement, that there were radical feminists who played an important role in bringing attention to the outrageous conditions such as rape, for example, happening to women. And we also had feminists working through NOW, the National Organization for Women, and through political channels to arrive at specific pieces of legislation that would promote more equal rights for women.
So, finally, you're both very thoughtful, introspective people. Do you feel outraged?
It ebbs and flows. But yeah, I would say there are things going on in the world that are deeply upsetting and yeah, I find myself like deeply angry about and wanting to see change. So I would say it's not a consistent or constant thing, but it ebbs and flows for me, sure.
Not the good kind.
Well, that's the struggle, right? Is to try to use those emotions in a productive way, just as Ellie was saying. Like when something's happening in the world that I see as egregious, like how can I channel those emotions into productive change? And I think that's my struggle, and that's something that I can see as an opportunity for growth.
Mm. Ellie, do you feel outrage?
Of course. I do feel outrage and have to figure out how to regulate that each and every day. And I do find peer support incredibly helpful for myself as well as the people I train in those methods, that being able to sit down, talk with someone, share how I'm feeling, listen to how they're feeling, can be important for realizing it's not just me, for remembering my connectedness with others, and being able to think more clearly about how I want to move forward.
Mm. Well, I don't feel outraged because I'm enlightened and I'm unreactive to things. I lose sleep. Yeah, I lose sleep too. And that's one of the reasons I mentioned earlier in the show that I'm so grateful to these young people from Parkland High School who have given me direction and leadership. It's brought a good deal of focused energy into my life. So we are out of time, and I want to thank you both for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks so much.
That was Michael Gariziak and Ellie Brown, both professors of psychology at Westchester University. We've been talking a lot about making contact with people and developing relationships. And one of the things we need to do is look in each other's eyes and see the humanity in the other person. The person we are looking at, just like us, suffers, wants security and safety, wants love in their lives and the ability to care for their families, just like us. And when we simply listen to their words without looking in their eyes and not seeing humans just like us, we lose a bit of our own humanity in this world. And that's a sad commentary. So I encourage all of us to look at those we disagree with and literally or figuratively look in their eyes and find their humanity, find their hearts, and you will find that by and large they are good people just like you, trying to do the right thing. Elizabeth Perez-Luda is the executive producer of Voices in the Family. Ali L'Esperance is our producer. Charlie Kyer has been our engineer. And to all of you, thanks so much for listening.